Next up is Ted Slingerland, who is Canada Research Chair in Chinese Thought and Embodied Cognition at the University of British Columbia. He works on Chinese thought, cognitive linguistics, cognitive science, evolutionary psychology, methodologies for comparative religion, virtue ethics in the classical Chinese language, and tap dances in his spare time.
Yes.
And he has a new book out called What Science Offers the Humanities, Integrating Body and Culture. So, Ted, take it away. Thanks.
Does this work with me wandering around? You can all hear me? I like to move it back. Let's see if this is going to work. It is. Excellent. So I've gotten used to being the token humanist in a room full of scientists, so I've also gotten in the habit of making things up when it comes to areas that I'm not a specialist in, like the French Enlightenment. So, you know, what do you know? You're a bunch of scientists. So Peggy's here and Darren's here, so hopefully you'll set me straight if I say something stupid about Voltaire. Because I'm picking up the computer software metaphor, and I want to start by talking about Enlightenment 1.0, working my way back and then up to 2.0. So Voltaire had a problem, as I understand it, and set me straight if this is wrong. He was opposed to the traditional Catholic Church and its institutions, but he had to respond to this critique, apparently very common critique, that without the church, without the threat of eternal damnation, you couldn't have morality. People would just go crazy without the threat of Judgment Day. So there's a good picture of what would happen. Human-sized blades getting stuck in other people. But there comes Jesus with a celestial carrot and stick to save the day. Now, Voltaire didn't buy this. He thought you could have a natural morality, something based on rationality. You didn't need a threat of damnation to get people to be good. And he thought he had basically an existence proof for this from a very exotic source. These Jesuit missions returning from China who had stories about Confucius, this supposed philosopher king of China, who coincidentally turned out to be a rational deist like Voltaire. So it worked out really nicely for him. So here's one of the first, I think, portrayals of Confucius, accounts of his teachings in the West, 1687, some French Jesuits. He looks like a reasonable guy, right? He also looks suspiciously European. He's got a very nice library, so he's a reader, he's a thinker. This portrayal, Voltaire's Confucius, has had a lot of power over the years. It survives to this day. You see it. It comes up in this idea of Confucius as a rational humanist philosopher. You'll hear a lot about Confucianism as a way of life rather than a religion. If you type Confucianism into Google, 98% of what you get up will tell you this. Now, I'm a specialist in early Chinese thought, so early, especially Confucianism, translated his works of Confucius, and I can tell you this is completely wrong. There's no way you could make this work. Confucius was, first of all, just a completely out-of-the-closet theist. He was a very explicit theist. He was on a mission from heaven. He was protected by and inspired by heaven. And this heaven, Tian, what we're translating as heaven, is an anthropomorphic being. It's capable of issuing orders, becoming angry. It's as full-blooded a theistic being as you could desire. So the question arises, what was Voltaire thinking? Because he actually had access to some reasonably accurate accounts of Confucius's teachings. And more importantly, what are my colleagues thinking? Because you continue, it's not just in Google that you see these things about Confucianism as a way of life, you know, rational way of life. You see it in published journals. So there's got to be a kernel of truth in this idea that Confucius was a philosopher of some sort. What are they getting? What are they working off of here? Here I want to go back now to Enlightenment version 0.5, the period that I study, the spring and autumn Warring States periods, very interesting time in Chinese thought. And interestingly, also a period of skepticism about the existence of ghosts and spirits. There was a growing worry or feeling that ghosts and spirits are not active in the world, and apparently even skepticism about the existence of heaven, or at the very least the desire or ability of heaven to intervene in human affairs. So you certainly are getting this what I'm going to call a supernatural minimalism, a growing sense of we want to rely less and less on postulating supernatural entities in our thought. So Confucian is a humanist in this sense. He was very focused on this world. He was reluctant to discuss supernatural and the afterlife. And he was theistic, but he had a very this-worldly ethic. His ethic was about this life and what's going to happen to you in this life. There's a great passage where this disciple says, can you tell us what happens to us after death? And he says, basically, just shut up and try to be a good person. You can worry about that later. Worry about this life now. People love that stuff, that passage. Interestingly, just structurally, it was accompanied by a lot of the same worries as Enlightenment 1.0. So for instance, there is a very popular criticism that the supernatural minimalism was leading to social chaos. And this was a period of social chaos, and you had a lot of people saying, well, it's a period of social chaos because we don't believe in ghosts and spirits anymore. And in fact, one philosopher in particular, this guy named Muozzi, was a strong theist, and he argued that ghosts and spirits were absolutely necessary. There's a whole chapter called Explaining Ghosts that's dedicated to explaining why the common people have to believe in ghosts and spirits if they're going to be ethical. So the same sorts of criticisms popping up as well. But despite Muozzi, supernatural minimalism was embraced by most of the major thinkers of the Warring States, including the Confucians, all the Confucians, really. And it reaches its apex in this, the last Confucian thinker in the Warring States, this guy named Xunzi, who people in the West don't know much about, but he's actually probably the most interesting thinker of the period. And he developed a really fully naturalized conception of morality. Tian, some people have argued in his thought, really shouldn't be translated as heaven anymore. It should be translated as nature, just the kind of background conditions humans create morality against. And he was also a very rabid supernatural minimalist. A very famous passage from Xunzi is this discourse on heaven. You pray for rain and it rains. Why? For no particular reason. It's just as though you had not prayed and it rained anyway. But the interesting thing is he wants us to still do the rain ceremony. He says it's very important that we still do the rain ceremony. And why is this? Because it brings people together and it makes them feel good. So we've got a very this-worldly, functionalist picture of what religious ritual is supposed to do. And if any of you are familiar with Durkheim, looks a lot. His attitude towards religious ritual looks a lot like Durkheim. And this is 3rd century BC China. Very interesting. They were interesting folks back then. So parallels between the 0.5 and version 1.0, I think they both feature a move toward naturalism, and they're both supernaturally minimalistic. But I think they also both have a bug that they share. They use this metaphor. They can't quite seem to get away from some sort of supernatural belief. So Confucius, of course, is explicitly theistic, as I've argued. Even Xunzi, who goes the farthest toward developing a naturalistic ethic, still has to fall back in this position that there's something unique about Confucian morality. It hooks people up to the cosmos in a special way. And he every once in a while falls into these strange poems where he says it makes the sun and the moon go around. And you're like, huh, what happened to supernatural minimalism? Very strange. And Voltaire, of course, he's a deist, right? He still believed in God. It just was a kind of stripped-down God that didn't, non-interventionist God. So why did this bug exist? One possibility is these folks just weren't consistent enough. They weren't good enough, and we have to finish the job. So that is a possibility. Another possibility is that this inability to get away entirely from supernatural belief tells us something about people, tells us something about the cognitive constraints on human cognition. And it's a second possibility that I want to support in time I have left. In this latter case, if the second's true, we're going to expect Enlightenment 2.0 to share the same bug that the earlier versions did. And I think that most thoughtful Western liberals, people who really think about it, realize that at some level they adhere to values that are grounded in the non-factual. And I use my example, Dan Dennett's recent book, Breaking the Spell, where he lays out what he calls his sacred values, right? Democracy, justice, life, love, and truth. Another point, he invites traditionally religious people to rejoin our political congregation, which I think is an interesting phrase. Now, I think it's being, of course, used, I assume it's being used tongue-in-cheek there. There's still a sense that there's something obviously different about our values, and that this is what allows us to lump all of them, those religious people over there on that side, and us secular people on this side. I think that this sharp distinction between religion and secularism is actually not maintainable. It's not as clear as it might seem. That's what my final argument today is going to be, drawing on the work of Charles Taylor, of course, the most recent recipient of the Templeton Prize. I couldn't resist using the Templeton picture just to piss Roger off. The Templeton event, right? But I'm actually interested in his earlier work, this 1989 Sources of the Self, Making of the Modern Identity. And he's got a bunch of claims, and that's a very important book, I think. But one of the most important claims he makes is that there are two types of judgments human beings can make. The first is what he calls a weak evaluation. So this is something like, I prefer vanilla ice cream over chocolate. It's a personal preference. I don't think there's anything special about it, transpersonal. And it's subjective. It's recognizably subjective and arbitrary. But there's another type of evaluation we make, what Taylor calls a strong evaluation. This is something like trafficking in child slaves is wrong. Now, what's special about this kind of claim? It has normative force. It tells you what's good or bad. The first one doesn't. I don't think people like chocolate are bad necessarily. They may be. empirically, but I don't think it necessarily is true. It's the other important thing about this is it's intolerant. When we have a strong evaluation, we want to impose it on other. I don't say, well, I don't believe in child slavery, but if you like it, go ahead. I want to make you stop participating in child slavery. And when I'm doing that, when I'm forcing you to, I'm putting you in jail, I'm sending UN peacekeepers in, whatever I'm doing to enforce this feeling I have, I have to justify it somehow. And the way I usually justify it is by referring to some sort of what Taylor calls ontological claim. And these are basically empirically unverifiable metaphysical entities that I invoke to justify the strength of my strong evaluation. So in the case of child slavery, we tend to appeal to something like human rights or the dignity of the individual. Maybe in the case of children especially, something special innocence about children. So according to Taylor, this is what a religion is. It's a framework of these ontological claims that give us normative guidance. In other words, that allow us to make strong evaluations. So he has a very broad definition of religion. And there's an issue of, do you make it so broad that it becomes useless analytically? But I actually think he stretches that but doesn't break it, because I think it's got some analytic teeth still. So in traditional religions, what we normally call religions, these metaphysical entities that lie behind, that are part of the framework, are explicitly the focus. So God, law of karma, Confucius is heaven. The weird thing about Enlightenment 2.0 is that it's a religion that denies that it's a religion. It's a strange type of religion. It's a new type of religion. And what does that mean? The metaphysical entities are not explicitly recognized. They're always there in the background, but they're not talked about too much. So we confess that we have values, but we tend to elide the issue of what these values are based on. We get uncomfortable when people start pressing us on this. And you need to do a little digging to get at them. So to do a little digging, if we want to talk about Dan Dennett's sacred values that he talks about, which I think are shared by everyone in this room, any modern Western liberal has them, right? What provides the warrant for these values? And I would argue it's certain beliefs, and they're metaphysical beliefs. So this human rights that I mentioned, to me, is as mysterious as the Holy Trinity. It's you can't do a CAT scan and show where human rights are. You can't cut someone open and show us their human rights. It's not an empirical thing. It's just something we strongly believe. And historically, it's actually coming out of Christianity. I mean, it's through Kant getting watered down through the Enlightenment 1.0 until with us. It's based on a kind of vague sense about something being special, dignified about people. So it's a purely metaphysical entity. It's immune to empirical inquiry. But it provides us with norms of behavior and intolerant norms. We don't tolerate intolerance. People are violating human rights, we send in troops, or we arrest them. We put them on trial. So what are the other elements of the Enlightenment 2.0 framework? Free will is certainly one of them. This lies behind, we think the idea that consensus is better than forcing people to believe something. But why would we think that? Most people haven't thought that historically. It's because we believe in free will. We like people to choose things. We believe in rationality as the royal road to truth. We believe in the importance of the individual an sich, right? And this leads to this weird modern liberal belief in diversity as a value, which is, again, historically, a pretty new idea. The idea that diversity in its own sake is valuable is not, you don't find a lot of historical cultures. And also, a very important thing is this, Taylor calls it the affirmation of ordinary life. The idea that there's something special and sacred about the life of production, being a parent, being a husband or wife, being a good friend, these are all parts of what it means to be human. And again, this is not an obvious value. Certainly the Homeric Greeks would think that being concerned with the life of production is womanish, right? Any real man is concerned with glory and death in battle. That's what matters, your name. So I think that this bug that I think Enlightenment 2.0 still has is something we can't seem to get away from, and it's because we can't get away from metaphysical beliefs at one level. And again, why not? I don't think it's because we haven't tried hard enough. I think it's because thoroughgoing non-belief is actually impossible for creatures like us, for psychologically healthy human beings. Now, Taylor makes this argument in terms of what he calls inescapable framework. So he says that living within a metaphysical framework that gives normative guidance, in other words, having a religion in his sense, is a transcendental condition of being a human being. And he says a human without a framework would be unrecognizable as a genuine human agent. And this is where I disagree with him a bit. I don't think we have to invoke kind of mysterious transcendental conditions. I think it's just very clear evolved constraints. It's how we're built. So what are some of the evolved constraints? I'm not going to, with this crowd, I'm not going to bore people with evolutionary theories of religion. Roughly, if you had to place me, I'm kind of an Autran-Boyer school person. I see religion as a byproduct, at least originally, of cognitive mechanisms that were evolved for other purposes that perhaps were exacted and then became adaptive in their own right. And I understand the whole group selection can of worms is going to get opened up later on by John. So possibly, yeah, some other people, and David. So, you know, possibly it became adaptive. Once I think they probably sprang up as spandrels, but then got exapted. But it really doesn't matter where it came from. The point is we have it. So what is one of these elements, one of these evolved constraints is clearly theory of mind. I mean, or intentional stance, if you prefer, if you the theory debate theory makes you uncomfortable. Paul Bloom's made a very strong case that we're born dualists. We can't help seeing minds in the world. And cognitive scientists of religion have used this observation to explain our tendency to see intentionality in supernatural beings everywhere. Stuart Guthrie was one of the earliest in the Faces in the Clouds, and Justin Barrett with his hyperactive agency detection device, right? Where we see agents where they don't exist. And what this means is that free will, choice, intention, purpose are inevitable furniture of the universe for creatures like us as bearers of theory of mind. And this also means that agents are inevitably special, because part of theory of mind is this idea that agents are different from objects. They have different properties. And behind that is this kind of sense that they're special. They possess a kind of dignity or specialness that objects don't have. I think this is really the root of the belief in the dignity of human beings. And when you look at people like Kant, what he's contrasting agents with is objects, right? Rational agents are not objects, and we shouldn't treat them like objects. Another of these evolved constraints are this set of strong evaluations, moral emotions that seem to be built into us. So innate feelings that seem to be a prerequisite for cooperation in any kind of extrafamilial scale. Well, a widely documented one is empathy. It doesn't seem to be confined to human beings. Another important one is justice, or this desire to altruistically punish. And I don't know if people have seen this PNA, recent article in PNAS that argues that at least 40% of the variation in people's responses to the dictator game, ultimatum game, the result of additive genetic effects. It was this big Swedish twin study, very interesting. So it seems to have some genetic basis in human beings. There's argument about whether or not apes or monkeys have it. But clearly we have these kind of moral reactions, and they're emotional in basis. So these two things, at least, I think there are others as well, but at least theory in mind and these moral emotions, they work together, and they reinforce one another. So moral emotions are linked ex post facto with entities and universal laws to provide justification. This is one of the things John's worked a lot on. We have these moral intuitions. We want to impose them on other people. We need a justification, so we make one up. And it often involves some kind of invocation of a moral law or some rational justification, but it's really about the feeling. We just don't like it. Maybe you can tell them about the Wheatley thing you did, the hypnotic suggestion. That's great stuff. But I think that the reason these won't go away is because they're the foundation of humans getting along in society. They're the foundation of any kind of humanly meaningful life. And I think if you actually meet someone who doesn't have functioning theory of mind and moral emotions, you should call 911, right? They're probably psychotic, and you should run and then call 911. So what this means, I think, is to put it provocatively, when he wanted me to be provocative. So religion will never go away, and it hasn't gone away, even though we think it has. So the supernatural is always going to coexist at some level with the factual. There's a problem with the Copernican analogy that some people in this room have used before. So they've argued, okay, we now know that there's no free will, we know there's no mind, the mind is just the brain, we know we're deterministic systems, and therefore folk psychology is just going to fall away, just like we got rid of the geocentric solar system. And I think the problem with that analogy is that the Copernican model, the solar system, goes against what our senses tell us and kind of common sense, but there's no Ptolemaic module in the human mind that needs to be overcome. The difference is with theory of mind is there is a theory of mind module. And it's not going away anyway soon, which means that folk psychology is not going to go away anytime soon. So in the end, then, I think it's not necessarily about secularism versus religion as if they were really clearly demarcated ways of thinking. It's really about what kind of religion do we want. And here I think that some are arguably better than others, and I think you can make this case on pragmatic grounds. So for instance, and this is another place where I disagree with Taylor, so don't follow him all the way. He thinks that since the Enlightenment religion relies on metaphysical entities, it's just like any other religion. So he basically argues human-level truths, courage, irony, things like this, because we can't do without them, he says, they're as real as anything studied by the natural sciences. They're on an equal footing, which means that in this respect, Enlightenment and, say, Catholicism are on an equal footing. They're both equally religions. I disagree with him here, and I think there's actually a superiority of the Enlightenment religion. It has a lot to do with why it's spread and continues to take over market share, if you want to put it that way, from traditional religions, at least in most parts of the civilized world, not necessarily in this country. The nice thing about living in Canada is you can make snarky comments about Americans. It's really fun. It's not quite worth paying twice as much for wine, but it's almost makes it worth it. So I think that human beings and actually other animals, other creatures, have what I'm going to call an empirical prejudice. Demonstrated factual claims have a unique power for us. They move us in a certain way. Because we're creatures that like to be well situated with regard to the structure of the world. So once the spell has been broken, to use Dan Dennett's phrase, we can't go back. It's importantly different to think that God really did create the world in 7 days and to think that it's a nice story that we hear and it could mean something for us, but it's not literally true. Those are important distinctions. And I have a great example of this from The Matrix, but it's going to take too much time. Ask me about this later over cheap American wine. But it's certainly the reason that there's been a systematic retreat of world religions in the face of scientific explanation. This is, again, where I disagree with people like Stephen Jay Gould with this two magisteria argument. That's new. And it's the reason there appears to be two magisteria, with religion just focusing on kind of ultimate meaning and things like this. It's because it's been forced systematically to retreat there by scientific inquiry. Religion used to explain everything, and now it's just been retreating. And I think that's continuing. So the strength of Enlightenment religion is that it's a religion of no religion. What this means, it's built on the recognition and indeed the moral demand, and this is interesting, to deny religion as part of its strength and morality and strong evaluation. So it's a very strange religion. The demand that naturalistic claims trump metaphysical ones. In this regard, then, it's relatively immune to corrosion from scientific inquiry. One of its values, central values, is that factual claims should take priority in important decision-making contexts. And I think the power of this practically, if you want to talk about just pragmatic payoff here, is we have the ability, even though we can't help feeling what Tom tells us, we can't help seeing minds out there. We can't help believing we have free will. We can bracket it because we know it's not true at some level. And this allows us to grapple with things like stem cell research and mental illness in ways that are very counterintuitive from the intentional stance or from the perspective of theory of mind, but recognizably helpful. They work. So this is, I think, this bracketing ability is a special thing that comes with having the religion that does. It's a kind of ironic religion in a way. You believe it, but you know it's not true. But you got to remember there's still something being bracketed. That theory of mind's still there, and it's going to pop up. And again, I think in the end, the theory of mind type stuff is always going to be more powerful in our everyday interactions. Evolution wouldn't have done a very good job if it were otherwise. This has a lot to do with why it's so hard to bracket these assumptions. It takes a lot of training and intellectual discipline. So to conclude then, to take on the Enlightenment 2.0 stance requires a kind of dual consciousness. It requires a recognition that the values and the cherished entities that populate our world aren't real. And this is what's so dangerous about Darwin's idea. And I agree with Dan Dennett's argument that it's the fundamentalists are the ones who really understand how dangerous evolution is. Most liberals are kind of like, oh yeah, I believe in evolution, and I also believe in free will and dignity. And they don't quite see how this is potentially problematic. So that one recognition, we have to realize they're not real. We also have to recognize, though, and this is important and sometimes overlooked, that we can't help continuing to feel that they are real in our everyday lives and the way we function in the world. So in other words, I think we're robots that are built to believe that we're not robots and that we don't live in a robotic world because we project theory of mind. We think what we do has meaning. We think our work means something. We think our lives are always put in terms of these narratives. And I actually think it's not just an accidental over-projection of theory of mind. I think it has actual functions. I think it allows human beings to actually maintain motivation over long scales of time. But that's a whole other argument I'd have to make. But just to talk about this interestingly, this type of dual consciousness pops up in earlier forms of the Enlightenment, and particularly in Enlightenment 0.5. There's this famous passage from Analects 3.12. The master said, when sacrificing to the spirits, and he's talking about the ancestral spirits here, you should comport yourself as if the spirits were present. And unfortunately, classical Chinese doesn't have subjunctive, so it doesn't have conditional tense of any kind. So there's debate about what he means by this. But I think it means that he's agnostic about the existence of the spirits. He's not sure whether or not they're there. But he also recognizes that public and private morality depend upon the reverence generated by their imagined presence. You have to believe that they're there for the ritual to work. And he thinks this is very important. And I think this is analogous to the role that entities like human rights or free will endowed moral agents play for us. At some level, we know they're not real. But if we actually tried to act in the world without ideas like free will and choice and responsibility, it's hard to, it would look like that painting from Bosch. It's hard to imagine what our lives would be like. So in conclusion, I think the trick of being an empirically responsible humanist or even a human in a physicalist age, in an age where the physicalist explanations seem triumphant and I don't really see any alternative to these, is to be able to simultaneously hold both the physicalist and human level perspectives in mind and employ each when and only when appropriate. Okay, thanks.
So let me just get some feedback from you because we're already running into time problems, as I can see. Are you itching to ask questions at this point? Or could you? Yeah, so what I'm going to suggest is that we do a few questions now before having done rather than finish up. Then we'll go to a late break, and then we'll come back and we'll do the opening part with Dan and David, and then we'll continue after lunch with that discussion as well, because we're going to have to slide it down a little bit, if that's okay. But I sense that I think there was enough meat there too. By the way, the current issue of Newsweek by Sharon Begley, the title is The Ghosts We Think We See. And it says a Gallup poll found that only 7% of Americans do not believe. I'll do that again. Only 7% of Americans do not believe in telepathy, deja vu, ghosts, past lives, or other supernatural phenomena. So, who? There was somebody was waving at me. Ronnie.
I agree with what I'm not quite sure whether you believe is a pessimistic view of our ability or inability to get rid of some of these psychological factors that somehow condemn us to religion. But it seems to me that the fact that we have a certain theory of mind is not something that should imply that we constantly use it on things that are not minds. And essentially, it seems to me that the tendency to attribute agency to non-agents is not likely particularly to raise humans in our estimation. And I don't understand why we can't actually exalt the wonder of a world without minds that is outside us and is different from the world of minds. And so, I mean, I think perhaps this is connected to my deep feeling of dissatisfaction about Taylor's book, but that's something we should discuss over coffee.
Chairman, do you want to talk on that?
Yeah, Michael Shermer. So that was a great talk, and I do a lot of public debates with theists, most recently Dinesh D'Souza, who makes this argument, not just that without God we can't be good, but that ultimately, these kinds of values have to come from some transcendent outside source. So I counter, and that takes him like 2 seconds. God did it. What's your answer? And then I give the 15, 20-minute answer that you gave, which I call a scientific or evolutionary ethics or some sort of grounding in science. But if I'm hearing you right, it's still ultimately a metaphysical leap there, which makes me a little uncomfortable because it then sounds like I'm no longer being Mr. Skeptic Science, that we're all taking some sort of leap of faith or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we are. I mean, I don't see what's scientific about human rights. We just believe it, right? And actually, there's a good historical story about why we believe it. It comes out of Christianity. Kant strips out a lot of the theistic stuff. So I think when you scratch a secularist, you find in the background these emotions that are ultimately aren't justifiable. They don't come out of science. Evolution doesn't tell us that we should value human rights or that we should all get together and have consensus or that it's better to win someone over with argument than to kill them. I mean, that's not obviously true.
right? It's actually probably much more effective usually to kill them and take their land and their stuff. But now we don't believe that's okay. But why is that? We fall back on these kind of beliefs that I don't think are scientific. I think they're better. I'm a liberal. I mean, I'm not. But I don't think we can't use science to justify them. We have to rely on these gut instincts, and then we dress them up in various ways.
Well, so let's go to Pat first, and then do Paul. Pat Churchland.
Yeah, okay. I think probably Don Rutherford should come before me. But let me just say one thing about this before we get too excited about the ontological and the metaphysical and just the great leap of faith and all that. And then is that, I don't make that great leap of faith. I mean, I think that human rights, to the degree that that can be given a concrete description, is something that works pretty well in a sheerly pragmatic way. I feel the need for Aristotle at this point. I do not feel the need for Plato and things in Plato's heaven at all. It's pragmatic. Human rights matter to me because, by and large, if you have a system that works according to those principles, you do better than if you have a tyrant, by and large. And so I would argue for the rest of the virtues. But let me hand this to Don Rutherford, because he really knows more about it than I do.
Actually, I'll just wait, because I'm in 5 minutes I'm going to say.
You're going to say all this stuff anyway. So let's go to Paul Churchland, who already has a microphone, is therefore in the commanding position.
Thank you. I'm sure I speak for everybody when I'd like to register delight with the first two talks. Yes. Thank you, folks. Those were just superb. But I am caught by Ted. Hello, Ted. I'm Paul. Nice to meet you, sir. I do admire your attempt to give a naturalistic account of the dimension of human cognition that we call morals and ethics and politics and so forth. But I, too, want to resist the skeptical pit into which you fall. And there is an alternative here, and I'll appeal directly to the analogy with science, the negative analogy that you drew. If you think of human history and all of the countries and all of the political and economic and religious organizations, the diverse ones that have governed sundry aspects of humanity over 2,000, 4,000, 10,000 years, you're looking at a series of experiments about how best to organize human affairs. Economic organization, civil organization, moral organization. And over that period, we've had a fair amount of wisdom emerge about how things are best organized. If one wants to take an objectivist view about the ground of morality, better to look at human history and what it teaches us over long periods of time than to made-up metaphysical things. Now, I know people do that, of course, but I don't think you should encourage them by saying it's inevitable. We can escape it, and to some degree we have.
Peg Jacob, you haven't.
I think one of the exercises that historians perform when they're less than comfortable with an idea is to historicize it. Theory of mind reminds me of the arguments that went on for centuries in the Christian West, namely that human beings have innate in them, an idea of God that they just can't get rid of. The travel literature finally undid that. And I'm wondering if travel in the mind, and more precisely in the brain, is not also going to undo Tom within possibly our lifetime. The other thing is that a lot of people have tried this, saying the Enlightenment is just another religion. It's in a Western context, even a non-Western context, it is the only quote-unquote religion that is totally without ritual, totally. And it strikes me that it's not quacking like a duck, it's not walking like a duck, and calling it a religion just doesn't help very much.
Okay. Lee, and then we'll go on to Don Rutherford.
When you say that,
it's Lee Silver.
Hi, Lee Silver. When you talk about a notion of human rights being non-scientific, I find that a bit troubling. It seems to me that things that we do are influenced either by our culture or by our genetic instincts or by some combination of the two. So human rights, in my mind, you can, I mean, part of it is natural human instincts. We as a species have instincts that are expressed to lesser or greater degree by different people that involve attitudes that lead to human rights at some level. And then you have the culture, okay? And the culture can be, you know, political culture or religious culture that, you know, forces people to do things. But there is probably this instinctual basis for a lot of the feelings we have. So we don't have to go transcendental. You can go inside into our genes. Most people don't want to admit that. But once you realize people have instincts, and we're, of course, the only species that knows that we have instincts, and some of them we can't help but follow, and others we try to stop from following. But, I mean, I think the instinctual basis for a lot of our behaviors is very important, and there's a science behind that.
Could you give that to Darren? Darren, did you want to have a comment on that? You don't have to, but... All right, okay. Dan Dennett?
Dan Dennett. I want to pick up on what Lee just said. Myopia is... we're stuck with it. No, we're not. We can wear eyeglasses. One of the things that we have with human culture is the capacity, thanks to our reflectiveness, to recognize the shortcomings and defects of our evolved nature and then find corrections. And if we look at the history of ethics, I think Hume is both an Enlightenment figure and also has some very elegant and impressive ideas about how the natural sympathies, our instinctual sympathies, they are indeed the basis, they are the foundation for our morality. But then we add artificial virtues on top of them. We develop, in effect, eyeglasses for the soul. And this is not, as you might say, a scientific development entirely. It is in large measure a political one. It is the history of political discussion and what Paul was talking about, this trial and error and what we've learned about what works and what doesn't work. And this eventually homes in on a set of ethical values. That's what I think ethical theory and ethics in philosophy has been really working on the last several thousand years. And the only sense in which it's sacred, I'm glad you picked up on that, I was, of course, referring to Philip Tetlock's elegant work in psychology, where a sacred value is one that you feel very uncomfortable challenging. But the whole reason that the Enlightenment is not a religion is that although we feel uncomfortable challenging our sacred values, we challenge them.
Ted, do you want to have a quick response before we move on? Well, quick.
I did what you told me to do, though. I got people riled up. That's good. I guess, well, there's a lot of different questions here. One issue is, you know, this thing about sacredness. It's not just that it makes us uncomfortable. It's that we feel, because it does do that too. It obviously, physiologically, it makes us uncomfortable. But we feel that there's something, you talk about this too, there's something wrong about even thinking about it, right? So there's a guy in the waiting room who's perfectly healthy. We've got 5 transplant patients who need organs, 5 organs. He's got 5 organs. Let's kill the guy, take his organs, and stick him in those people, right? Why don't we do that, right? It bothers us, right? And then we also feel this need to justify why we're bothered, and that's when we make that move. So I guess that it's true we don't have to take the turn to transcendence, but we do. And this is I think it's an experimentally verifiable claim. And I think people like John are working on this sort of stuff, John Haidt. You know, when we feel pressed, when our strong evaluations come online, for some reason, we feel the need to not just say, I feel this. Because you don't just say, I feel it would be wrong to let people enslave children. You want to say that it's actually wrong. Objectively, there's a realism to it. And that's where we start making appeal to these entities that aren't. But then I think you can then fall. But the beauty, I agree, the beauty of the Enlightenment position is this bracketing ability, right? We know it's sacred, but we're going to ask about it anyway. And that's what makes it so powerful. And that's what allows it to do these pragmatically, very obviously useful things. And that's why, actually, I think you can also make the case pragmatically that it's driving out other religions, because people find it more satisfactory as a way of life and an explanation. But I just, what I want to fight,
because I think if you look at anyone defending Enlightenment values, I do this when I can't help it. It's almost become this tick. But I go through and I start circling the values they have and what the probable metaphysical entities they invoke if I ask them why they believe these things. So I agree, you don't have to make the transcendent move, but people do. And again, it's part of how we evolve. We just feel like we need to because we want it to be real. We don't want it to just be a private thing.
Okay, we can do more on moral intuitions and trolley problems and all sorts of things later on. And I'm just going to rush off and start a business selling eyeglasses for the soul, I think, which is a great idea, Dan.